You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 17th of June 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up on today's programme, we'll have the latest on renewed clashes between Israel and Hamas and profile Benjamin Netanyahu's successor, Naftali Bennett.
Given the sprawling size and unruly disparity of the coalition he has assembled and the volatility of Israeli politics generally, we'd better be quick.
Plus, we look ahead to Iran's presidential elections and ask what the outcome could mean for the country's future direction. We'll also discuss LGBT rights in Hungary, review the day's papers, and hear from the winner of a top photojournalism award who captured the destruction of the Amazon.
Cattle ranchers and landowners planned it on WhatsApp. And they coordinated like to put fire all together on the same day. And from that time, then like the fire started like to spread all over the region.
That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Hundreds of security officials have raided the offices of Hong Kong's pro-democracy newspaper, Apple Daily. A number of executives have been arrested. The US President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin have praised their talks in Geneva. Biden said it could be a step to improving ties with Moscow. And the World Bank has rejected a request from El Salvador to help introduce Bitcoin. The Central American nation wants to be the first in the world to adopt Bitcoin as tender. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, at least 256 people were killed in Gaza last month in a bitter 11-day conflict between Hamas and Israeli forces. There were 13 deaths in Israel before an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire took effect on the 21st of May. But now Israel says it has carried out airstrikes in Gaza in recent days after Palestinians launched incendiary balloons from the territory. Well, let's get the latest from Jerusalem with Alison Kaplan-Sommer, who's a journalist for Haaretz. Alison, and what sparked this flare-up? How did the Jerusalem Flag Day march play into it?
Yes, so the original march was supposed to have been taking place on May 10th. And that is when, you recall, the Hamas leaders in Gaza fired rockets at Jerusalem. So that, A, halted the march, and B, set off 11 days of fighting and the exchange of fire between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. So it was rescheduled by the organizers. And in the last days of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's administration. And there was a lot of going back and forth. The police recommended against it, saying that it was a national security risk. The government insisted that it take place, saying that it would be a sort of a surrender of sovereignty over Jerusalem if it was not allowed to take place. As I said, he put the landmine in Bennett's court by rescheduling it for Bennett's reign, and Bennett's people negotiated a less inflammatory route, because instead of waving flags, marching right through the Muslim quarter, antagonizing the Palestinian citizens, they did a more circuitous route around the old city. But yet Hamas in Gaza did not feel that this could go unresponded to, and that is why, while they didn't fire rockets, they used this as a reason to begin sending again incendiary balloons into Israeli territory and setting off fires.
And so tell us more detail about how Israel reacted.
So the first balloons were sent on Tuesday, right after midnight, technically on Wednesday, but really Tuesday night. There were attacks by Israeli forces on Gaza after Israel, you know, had warned Hamas via Egypt that there would be tough and immediate response to any kind of fire from coming from the Hamas side. But what's interesting is even though there was retaliation on Tuesday night, balloons continued yesterday on Wednesday, setting off four fires, damaged acres of lemon and clementine groves. Last night there was no Israeli attack, which is sort of indicating that perhaps this administration, that Naftali Bennett's government, is hoping that it can calm this down quickly, and that it could be a one-time response to the flag march and not necessarily escalate into a greater confrontation. And the two sides can continue under the table, using people in the middle to mediate, continue to negotiate for some sort of longer-term quiet.
So, in other words, Naftali Bennett and his administration could signal a real change of course for Israel.
Well, they could. I don't know if we want to base that assumption on the activities or the fact that, no attacks took place on one night. But, it is a sign. It is a small sign that perhaps they're going to try to do things in a way that keeps things calm. Certainly, no incoming prime minister with a very fragile, diverse coalition, with the former prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, basically breathing down his neck and putting a lot of pressure on him and saying that, at any moment he wants to return to power and come back. I don't think Bennett can afford at this point to allow this to escalate into a major exchange of fire combat situation. He's not secure enough in his office, I think, to withstand a real crisis this soon.
How has the country reacted to his leadership?
It's only been 3 days, so people feel like they need to give him a little time. Feel like there is, there is a feeling of relief, and there is a feeling that that it is time. The demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu were really huge, and they encompassed the entire country. They were on a large scale. There was a large national feeling that that it was time for him to go. And by contrast, the forces that Netanyahu is trying to sort of gin up against Bennett, the demonstrations against Bennett have been very small, and really the atmosphere seems to be, let's give this government a chance to succeed.
Thank you very much, Alison. That was the journalist Alison Kaplan-Sumar speaking to us from Israel. So who exactly then is Israel's new Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett? Well, here's Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller, with this week's Foreign Desk Explainer.
Benjamin Netanyahu made a political career from sowing division. It is therefore remarkable that after 15 years in two stints as Prime Minister of Israel, he has at last succeeded in uniting the country against him. Back in March, Israelis voted in their fourth general election in 2 years, and it is now finally confirmed, gave Netanyahu's many and varied opponents just enough seats to unload him. This is not the time nor place to assess the legacy of Benjamin Netanyahu, not least because there may well still be more to it. Despite his removal from the top job and the fact that he is still on trial on corruption charges, Netanyahu remains the leader of the largest single party in the Knesset and has more than once before emerged triumphant from an apparently impossible position. He is a man entitled to regard Lazarus as an amateur. This is, however, the time and the place to assess the prospects of Israel's new Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett. And given the sprawling size and unruly disparity of the coalition he has assembled, and the volatility of Israeli politics generally, we'd better be quick, lest this explainer last longer than his government does. Some basics first. Naftali Bennett, Israel's 13th Prime Minister, is 49 years old and of American descent. Like his former ally, Benjamin Netanyahu, Bennett served as a younger man in the elite Sayeret Matkal Commando Unit of the Israel Defense Forces. After leaving the military, Bennett made a tidy fortune in computer software. His entry into politics was as chief of staff to Benjamin Netanyahu, then leader of the opposition. Bennett later served under Netanyahu's leadership as Minister of Education and Minister of Defense, among other roles. Bennett now leads the hawkish conservative Yamina list, which holds just 7 seats in the current Knesset. He needed to find 53 more to give his coalition a 1-seat majority, and he did it by wrangling 7 other parties who have little in common beyond a desire to see the back of Benjamin Netanyahu. These include the stolid centrists of Yesh Atid and Blue and White, the conservative nationalists of Yisrael Beitenu, the liberals of New Hope, the centre-leftists of Labour, the leftist-leftists of Meretz, and most astonishingly, the Arab Islamists of Ra'am. It is the first time that a party representing Israel's Arab citizens has been in government. Bennett also agreed, as a condition of becoming Prime Minister, to announce when he'd leave the job. If the coalition holds, though that is an if so big one would need Sherpas and Yaks to climb it, he will step down in 2 years and hand over to Yesh Atid leader and former TV news anchor Yair Lapid.
We can form a government within 48 hours with Likud, with Kahol Lavan, Israel Beitenu, Yamina and ourselves, which will be a smaller, more effective, more efficient government.
If this all sounds mad and obviously unworkable, there are 2 reasons for this. One is that it's all mad and obviously unworkable. The other is that it's Israeli politics. Not once since the state was founded in 1948 has any one party held a parliamentary majority. And the idea of a rotating premiership is not an entirely new one in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu and Blue and White leader Benny Gantz were supposed to have reached such an arrangement in Israel's previous government before that coalition imploded.
And Netanyahu betrayed my credit and the credit that the people gave him.
And Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Shamir actually executed such a swap in 1986. The question now raised is what kind of Prime Minister Naftali Bennett will be in the 2 years he has promised himself in the job. The answer, in many respects, may well be not noticeably different from the Prime Minister he has replaced. Bennett, like Netanyahu, is a security-first hardliner, a determined supporter of West Bank settlers, and not noticeably interested in pursuing any resolution to the Palestinian issue, least of all in helping to midwife a sovereign Palestinian state.
I vehemently oppose the notion of forming another failed Arab state in the heart of Israel. That's crazy.
Bennett once likened Israel's conflict with Palestine to, as he put it, shrapnel in the buttocks, i.e. a probably incurable injury, which, while irritating, is manageable. As to how wise Bennett would be to get invested in any plans he may have for redecorating the Prime Minister's residence, who knows? The things binding his coalition together, dislike of Netanyahu, reluctance to instruct Israelis back to the polls for the 5th time in 3 years, are vastly outnumbered by the things which may break it apart. And that's before you consider the colossal grudge-bearing capacities of the seething enemy they've ousted.
We'll be back soon!
After the vote to confirm the new government in the Knesset, Benjamin Netanyahu sat back down in the Prime Minister's chair instead of at his new place on an opposition bench. It didn't look altogether like an accident. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Many thanks to Andrew. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Iran goes to the polls on Friday, or at least that's the plan. In reality, the election is expected to set new records for low turnout. But is this a deliberate boycott or just voter apathy? Holly Dagres is senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and she joins me now. Holly, thanks for coming on the programme. Let's begin with who's running, because this is tightly controlled by the Guardian Council, who approved only 7 out of 592 presidential candidates. Why is that?
Well, that's an important question. The Guardian Council is a vetting body that traditionally only allows about 7 or 8 candidates to run. But what we actually saw here was that a lot of the rival candidates, folks like former Speaker of Parliament Ali Larijani, being disqualified from the election. And it became clear that this was essentially a one-horse election. I should note that since yesterday, we've actually had 3 out of 7 candidates actually withdraw. So now we're down to 4.
The Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, did try and get that decision reversed by the Guardian Council, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And well, a lot of analysts like myself saw that as a way of him absolving himself of responsibility, because at the end of the day, he is the sole decider on what happens in the country. And what we've been seeing is actually in the past few years, this consolidation of power by hardliners. So last year in February 2020, we had parliamentary elections in which many reformist candidates were disqualified, and that led to a low voter turnout, and also in part because Iranians were very much fed up with the reform with the state of affairs on the ground. And so in the end, we had a hardline majority parliament, and this is exactly what seems to be happening here right now, is that a hardline candidate, Judiciary Chief Ebrahim Raisi, will very likely win tomorrow's election. And that's the plan.
Tell us more about Raisi.
Well, Raisi was not a household name until the 2017 election. He ran as the rival main candidate against incumbent president, moderate president Hassan Rouhani. And over the years, he's become much more well-known. He became the country's judiciary chief just a couple years ago. He is a hardline candidate, which essentially means that he has traditionalist views. And we don't know enough about his worldview. We do understand, though, however, he is a supporter of the Iran nuclear deal because it has endorsements of the Supreme Leader. But other than that, he hasn't really come out and said much about what he plans to do with the country. He has also been running a anti-corruption drive for the past couple of years since he took over as judiciary chief. But we've also understood that to be a him consolidating power, because he's been going after moderate and reformist individuals within the country. So it's clear that he has his own agenda to help his own party.
Mm. And just tell us more about why Iranians don't want to vote. I mean, is it apathy or an organized boycott?
Well, it's a mix of both. Iranians have a list of long grievances that have developed over the past few years. And a lot of it is has to do with mismanagement and corruption and the state of the economy, which was partly also caused by the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal and the reimposition of sanctions in May 2018. We've also seen a rise in repression over the past few years. Of course, there was the November 2019 protests that were over a fuel strike that led to the killing and arrest of thousands of Iranians. And overall, Iranians are also looking at the reformist faction and the moderates and saying, well, what have you guys done for us for the past few years? You've made all these promises, but you've really not acted on any of them. So why should we even care about voting anymore when you're not even delivering on anything? So there's a mix of things going on there. And we've heard Iranians say they're just not interested in voting or that they're purposely boycotting. We've also seen prominent activists also sign a petition saying that they're not going to vote in this election and that they're boycotting it. So what we're really expecting tomorrow is a historically low turnout. Official polls are predicting something around the percentile of 37% to 43%, which would be a historical low for the country over the past 42 years.
I mean, they may not be planning to turn up at polling stations, but they are certainly politically engaged. What sense are you getting from nightly social media debates and Twitter hashtags?
Well, since February, we've seen an influx of Iranians on Clubhouse, the audio-only app, and practically every night we're having countless debates being formulated on Clubhouse. Last night, for example, I was in a room with a a known reformist from the 1990s. He's an old man now. And all of a sudden, someone said, we're going to bring in presidential candidate Abdel Nasser Hemati. He's essentially right now the only so-called rival candidate in this race. And he spent a good half an hour explaining what he was going to do for the country and how actually he felt that this was an unfair election. We've also seen these hashtags on social media, no way I'm voting, I will not vote. And I should note with the caveat that some of these are also tweets from people that are living abroad, that are in the diaspora or exiled. So we've also been seeing a lot of that as well, that people are actually voicing their discontent online and on Clubhouse. So it's been a very interesting debate to follow, thanks to social media applications.
Mm. And Holly, given that Raisi is almost certain to win, what does this mean for the future of Iran?
Well, frankly, the future looks very bleak. Again, we don't know enough about his views, but given that he is a hardline candidate, it gives a sense that Iran is moving possibly towards a North Korea-like isolation. The fact that this would mean that all three branches of Iranian government will be led by a hardliner is very problematic, and it means that things could be worse on the ground. Repression could be even more on the rise. And so Iranians are, I think, not too happy about things on the ground. But at the same time, they're not willing to do anything about it because there isn't really much for them to do when the election's basically rigged in favor of one candidate.
Holly, thank you very much indeed. That's Holly Degress. Now, still to come on the programme, we'll review the day's papers, speak to the winner of this year's Prix Carmignac Photojournalism Grant, and review the week's film news too. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
In North Korea, the governing Workers' Party Central Committee has been meeting. According to state media, the officials set goals and tasks to achieve its new five-year economic plan outlined at its previous session in February, including increased food and metal production. This comes amid reports of famine in the country and speculation about Kim Jong-un's health. However, there may be more to it than that. John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, joins me now to explain. John, what's really going on?
It's big. Back in January, they had not just a plenum, which is what's going on now, but a full party congress, a rare event. And everyone thought, ooh and ah. But just a couple of weeks ago, we found leaked documents. You have to get leaked documents out of North Korea, where it turns out that the congress had changed the internal party rulebook. Now, this sounds nerdy and bureaucratic, until you realise that, firstly, that means they are about to appoint a deputy to Kim Jong-un. That's interesting. They have changed their stance on international relations, and they have enabled the Politburo, any member of the Politburo, to chair meetings, which means the government could go ahead without Kim Jong-un being present. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about Kim Jong-un's health. The man puts on weight, people think he's got a health problem. He loses weight, people think he's got a health problem. He must be even rather confused, poor man. But I think this is a much clearer indication that the regime is very worried that it may have to struggle on without a ruling Kim at some point. So you put the structures in place to keep going if that happens.
So, in fact, what's driving this change is their worry about his health?
Well, his worry about his health, or there's an alternative explanation. It may be that his weakness isn't medical, but political. Maybe this is the regime looking to quietly sideline the Kim and actually go for a form of collective government. That, too, is consistent with these changes.
So, in January, Kim said his previous five-year economic plan had failed in almost every sector, and that was amid chronic power and food shortages exacerbated by sanctions, the pandemic, floods and all the rest. At this meeting, he claimed the overall economy had improved in the first half of the year with, he said, total industrial output growing 25% from
giggle,
the year before.
Giggle, giggle, giggle.
Well, yes, I mean, can both statements be true?
No, of course they can't. 25% growth. You can see an economy that's growing at 25%. North Korea is not growing at 25% a year. That's just a number plucked from the air. The worries over food production, however, are probably right. Now, this is interesting, because this is the remark that Kim made that so many people have focused on. A tense situation, he said, in food production. Does this mean famine? And clearly, the regime is very worried. But here you come up against the big gap between what is going on and what the regime thinks is going on. Interestingly, only yesterday, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations updated its report on North Korea and said, actually, it's not that bad. I mean, they're short of food. They're always short of food. And they need to find another 860,000 tons of grain from somewhere. Otherwise, between August and October, they will go through what they call a hard, lean period. But 860,000 tons, it's the kind of amount that China, possibly even Russia, might well stump up. There may be a famine later this year. I mean, heaven forfend. But I don't think we can, you know, we can be certain of that by any means.
Pandemic? I mean, there have been no official reports of COVID-19 in the country, but we do know that there are strict antiviral protocols in place.
Strict? I mean, when you say strict, North Korean strict is like you've never seen anywhere else. Absolutely. Nothing moves, nothing breathes, nothing sneezes without special permission. And the border's completely sealed. One interesting point that's just come out of the plenum is that Kim Jong-un has admitted that this is going to be a long-term struggle. There's no sign of these measures being lifted anytime soon. Now, that, quite apart from the inconvenience, shall we call it, that's caused to ordinary North Koreans, has devastating effects on the economy. North Korea has effectively shut down its international trade, which means that it's short of foreign exchange. It can't buy in the medicines, can't buy in a lot of the industrial plant that it is looking for. And this is clearly a big headache for the government.
And are they getting vaccines?
They are getting a few, but nowhere near enough. They're getting some from COVAX, although that delivery's been delayed for all the usual COVAX reasons. They have had a few vaccines in from Russia, almost certainly some from China, though the Chinese haven't published figures. But they are still tens of millions of doses short.
Yeah. Can we just go back to Kim Jong-un's weight?
Okay.
I mean, the Western media does seem to be very obsessed with this.
Yes, it's a great story, isn't it? One of the joys about writing about North Korea is that you can write what you like. Nobody can actually disprove what you're saying. And a fat leader, yes, you know, it's good headline stuff. He has been obese. He was grossly overweight for most of this year, and he disappeared for long periods. In fact, he disappeared for about 3 weeks, I think it was, just a couple of weeks ago. Maybe he's undergoing treatment of some kind, or maybe there are other reasons. But now he reappears, and he's lost a lot of weight. There's been a whole a black science has developed around Kim Jong-un's the band of his wristwatch. People are counting how many notches on his wristwatch band he has to fasten to get the thing on. And he can wear it a lot looser now than he was able a month ago.
But could it just be that he spent 3 weeks at fat camp and he's embracing a new, healthier lifestyle?
Precisely. I mean, this may mean absolutely nothing. In fact, it may be good news as far as his health goes. Maybe he went on a diet as simple and basic as that. You know, if we're worried that being overweight causes health problems, then presumably we should welcome the fact that he's lost weight because that means he's a bit healthier.
So, John, if you were to interpret all of this, could it in fact mean a rosier future for North Koreans?
Yes, the changes they've made to the party rulebook don't make changes, but they enable changes. It means that, for example, you could run without the Kims. Also, very quickly, on international relations, they've changed the bit about liberating South Korea, which means that in future, if anybody decided to take up President Moon Jae-in of South Korea's offer for a roadmap towards reunification, that no longer conflicts with the party rulebook. That's a big step.
Huge. John, this is a story I'm sure we will be covering a lot again in the future. Thank you very much for coming in. That was John Everard there. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Hundreds of security officials have raided the offices of Hong Kong's pro-democracy newspaper, Apple Daily. The media group's editor-in-chief and four other executives were arrested at their homes. The paper's owned by Jimmy Lai, who's in jail for supporting Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement. The US President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin have praised their talks in Geneva. Biden said the pair voiced their disagreements and that Russia did not want a new Cold War. Biden added that there was now a genuine chance of improving relations with Russia. The World Bank has rejected a request from El Salvador to help introduce Bitcoin as legal tender. The Central American nation had hoped to become the first country to formally adopt the digital currency, but the World Bank has expressed concerns over Bitcoin's transparency and environmental impact. And today's Monocle Minute reports on a surge in the number of counterfeit goods being sold online. The study by the European Union Intellectual Property Office said 1 in 10 Europeans said they were misled into buying fake cosmetics, clothing and pharmaceuticals. You can find out more at monocle.com/minute. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. On Tuesday, Hungary's parliament passed a law that bans the dissemination of content in schools deemed to promote homosexuality and gender change. The hardline nationalist Prime Minister Viktor Orbán and his Christian conservative Fidesz party attached the proposal banning school talks on LGBT issues to a separate, widely backed bill that strictly penalises paedophilia. Although this triggered mass protests outside parliament and a boycott by leftist opposition parties, Fidesz lawmakers overwhelmingly backed the legislation. Well, Justin Spike, AP contributor and journalist in Budapest, joins me now. Justin, thanks for coming on The Globalist. What are the provisions of this new law and how could it affect Hungary's LGBT community?
Good morning and thanks for having me. Yes, this new bill essentially serves to prevent the portrayal or promotion of homosexuality or any sexuality other than heterosexuality to young people under the age of 18. And as you mentioned, it also bans the portrayal of gender reassignment to minors. The fact that it was connected to a bill which was ostensibly to fight pedophilia has a lot of people concerned that this is a deliberate conflation of homosexuality or of sexual minorities with pedophilia and with pedophiles. Mm. So this concern obviously leads to worries that that this legislation will serve to further alienate and incite resentments and fears of the LGBT community here in Hungary, where already this community feels that it's largely alienated from the majority of society.
Now, of course, we know that there's an election coming up. So is this being used by Fidesz to manufacture a new enemy and perhaps split the opposition?
Well, there's a lot of speculation on this, on why such a bill was necessary to put forward. We do have an election coming up next, next year in the spring. So it is an election year and the campaign has already kicked into gear. Putting this legislation forward is interpreted by many as the ruling party Fidesz seeking a new enemy. This is something that this government has thrived on for quite a number of years. This legislation really resembles a lot of steps that the government took in 2015 and thereafter, after the refugee crisis of that year, at a time when it took great steps to prevent refugees or asylum seekers from coming into Hungary, essentially by rhetorically conflating refugees with terrorists or asylum seekers with terrorists. That's really similar here to what the legislation does and to conflate homosexuals with pedophiles. Mm. It's a way to consolidate the conservative voting base of the ruling party ahead of elections. That's the speculation by many critics of this law.
But I mean, it also didn't come out of the blue. I mean, Orbán's government has long signaled its homophobia.
That's true. This is not the first. This is not the first example of legislation which serves to alienate this community. But also, this serves another purpose. It's the next in a series, and it appears to be leading up to really tight elections, or what are expected to be very tight elections next year. So here in Hungary, the governing party led by Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, they've been in power since 2010. So for over 10 years now, But the spring elections are going to be the most competitive that they've had to face because of a coalition of six opposition parties who have agreed to work together. But in terms of splitting the opposition, as you mentioned earlier, this bill was supported not only by the ruling Fidesz party, but by one conservative right-wing party, Jobbik, which is also in opposition, but was not supported by the left-wing parties. So this bill also served to sort of split this tenuous alliance between these opposition parties.
Mm. And what about the EU? Could and should they be taking a stand on this?
A lot of critics of this law are demanding that they do so. And there are signs that might indeed happen. So Germany's government has condemned this law as patent state discrimination against LGBT people. The president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said that the commission will examine whether it breaches EU law. And if that happens, then it could go before the European Court of Justice. And if a decision is handed down there which says that it has breached EU law, then it will have to be revoked or amended. The thing is that these things often take many months or more typically years. So until that such a time that the EU is able to use some of its capacities to strike down or otherwise to amend this law or call for its amendment, the LGBT community here in Hungary will have to live with the facts of the law as it stands today.
Justin, thank you very much indeed. That was Justin Spike, and this is The Globalist. This year's pre-Carmignac photojournalism grant was given to Italian photographer Tommaso Protti, who used it to document the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. Monocle's Alexis Self spoke to Tommaso about his work titled Amazonia.
The Prix Carmignac is a €50,000 grant awarded annually to a photojournalist engaged in the reportage of human rights violations or geostrategic issues in the world. This year's laureate, Tommaso Protti, is an Italian photographer who over 6 months travelled thousands of miles across the Amazon region of Brazil, documenting the ecocidal destruction of the rainforest and the humanitarian plight of the region's peoples. Tommaso joined me from his home in Sao Paulo to discuss the work he created there, titled Amazonia, which is currently on show at London's Saatchi Gallery. I started by asking him what had shocked him most on his journey.
For me personally, the episode that marked me mostly was like the killing of indigenous activists from the Guajajara indigenous tribe that he was called Paolo Paulino. I didn't witness like the murder, but like I spent with him approximately 1 week. I was following this Guajajara forest guard for a week during one patrol that they were doing inside this reserve, indigenous reserve, that is the Araribaya reserve in the Maranhão state. They were looking for illegal loggers invading their lands, and they were looking to destroy their camps or just like find them in order like to expel them from the indigenous territory. Paolo was one of the first members of the forest guard that I met, and I was really connected with him. He was a bit younger than me. He was 26 while I'm 35. Was a really curious man. But at that time, I didn't perceive like the danger he was actually experiencing, because of course when we were in during the patrol, once we just reached like this loggers camp, but the logger were escaped at that time, and the guardians, the forest guards, put fire on the camp. When we were going out from that area. And we heard some gunshots in our directions, and we didn't stop. We kept going because like we didn't know from where like the gunshots were coming, but like there was a serious threat. Like so, were loggers like treating us? I mean, I wasn't scared, but like it was a real dangerous situation.
And on top of the murders of environmental activists in Amazonia, you have also the threat of forest fires. Were you there during the huge forest fires in 2019?
I've been there in it was August 2019, Just a week after, like, the fires started, the fires like started with a coordinated action on the 10th of, or the 9th of August. I don't remember clearly the date, but like it basically like a group of cattle ranchers and landowners planned it on WhatsApp. And they coordinated like to put fire all together on the same day. And from that time, then like the fire started like to spread all over the region. And I went to cover the fires in the state of Rondônia. The fires were not like really close to the cities, but like you had to drive a bit and go inside the reserves where the fires were taking place. And the fact was like that sometimes you didn't know where you were eating, and these places are huge, and so like I was following, I put on my GPS and the satellite to see exactly where I was, but like we were also worried like to be stuck in the middle of two fires, and the scenario was kind of apocalyptic because it was burned fields, burned vegetation. And there was smoke all over, and it was pretty, in some area was even like difficult to breathe sometimes.
And are you looking with your photos to communicate that horror and that distress? And if so, how do you do that using your photographs?
I mean, I always like act as a witness, and with my photograph, I just want to tell what's going on, but also I also try like to use my vision as a photographer, telling everything with my visual language.
That was Tommaso Protti speaking to Monocle's Alexis Self. Amazonia is showing at the Saatchi Gallery in London until Sunday, the 18th of July.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time to take a look at the day's newspapers now with Ian Anderson, who's former political advisor and chairman of international communications agency Cicero Group. Good morning to you, Ian.
Good morning.
Let's start with the New York Times. Of course, most of the papers carry this story, but they are talking about the summit between Biden and Putin.
That's right. And, you know, the kind of headline here is that Biden and Putin express a desire for better relations. Look, we're going to have to wait a long time to see whether or not there are going to be better relations between these two great powers. There's a huge question, of course, as to whether or not actually with China's rise, something we'll be talking about again later in this review, is this just a bit of a sideshow? But kind of some fairly substantive thoughts that have come through from this summit. So a bit of a thawing of relations. I love the way the New York Times describes the two men as like two skilled boxers describing each other's prowess in the press conferences, which they held simultaneously afterwards. Unlike Putin and Trump, they didn't actually appear on a platform together. So they clearly wanted to demonstrate their own distance, but they're sending ambassadors back to each other's capitals. There are going to be some working groups, and kind of really feels like both men really need relations to thaw and get on a more stable footing.
Yes, I mean, Biden was very reassuring in that he said Putin does not want a new Cold War.
That's right. He absolutely doesn't. In fact, there's a rather brilliant quote just at the sort of back end of the piece, kind of taking us back 36 years to the time when two other American presidents, in this case Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, met in Geneva in 1985, and the statement that the leaders issued yesterday, pledging that a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. That's a direct quote. So, look, there's a sense here that maybe both men want to sort of step back from the very icy relations that have developed between the US and Russia over the past decade. They're both thinking about China when they say this.
Well, let's talk about China, or more specifically Hong Kong. The South China Morning Post has reports about the arrest of the editor of the Apple Daily. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this has happened literally just overnight. It is literally breaking news. This is the newspaper, the Apple Daily, that's owned by the billionaire Jimmy Lai. Jimmy Lai, of course, is in jail himself right now for alleged breaches of the new national security legislation. And this morning, according to this report, 200 police officers, in some other reports I'm reading, 500 police officers have swept in on the offices of Apple Daily. They've arrested the editor-in-chief. They've arrested the publisher. And they're saying, the Hong Kong authorities, the security services, are saying that Apple Daily has breached the national security law by colluding with foreign governments. I think, you know, this law is so widely drawn, it's giving the Hong Kong security services, and ultimately China, the ability to take this kind of action. But it's another dark day for freedom of expression and democratic sentiment in the former colony.
Meanwhile, mainland China has produced a unicorn for us all to be involved with. That is their first crew launched off to a new space station, something to distract us, perhaps.
Well, maybe, yes. So literally, just as this was happening, precisely as you put it, Georgina, China's first manned space crew for 5 years blasted off from the Gobi Desert earlier this morning. It's heading towards the new Chinese space station, 260 miles above us up in orbit. The crew is due to be on board for at least 3 months. Previous Chinese missions have only lasted about a month or so, we're told. And this new space station, the Chiangnong space station, was only started in April this year. So they're moving really, really quickly. The Guardian piece that I'm reading, of course, makes the point that next month is going to be the 100th birthday of the Chinese Communist Party. So this is a real showcase event and real kind of, this kind of harks back to the 1960s and 70s, where the space race was a way to demonstrate global power.
Absolutely. Now, Ian, can I ask you a rather personal question?
Oh, go on.
What are you wearing? Are you in your pyjamas?
I'm not in my pyjamas, but given the weather in London this week, I'm definitely in a pair of shorts.
The reason I ask that, of course, is that the Daily Mail is reporting that we could all be working from home forever, which means, of course, we'll all be working in our pyjamas or perhaps just our shorts.
Yeah, this is a really important story about the future of work. Basically saying that certainly here in the UK, the government is looking at changing legislation to give workers a right to stay away from the office, to make it illegal for companies to force people back to an office, unless employers can show that being in an office is absolutely essential. It points out actually that before even we got to the pandemic, in the Conservative manifesto in the UK general election back in 2019, they looked at a measure like this in order to encourage flexible working. This will have a lot of employers scratching their heads today. It's a sort of foretaste of maybe what is to come, a permanent shift in how we work.
I mean, the paper warns of zombie towns. I mean, what will this do to city centres?
Well, this is the huge concern. I mean, it quotes several Conservative MPs who are extremely anxious about the ongoing lockdown taking place, that by making this move, if the government does make this move, that you know, you're just not going to see the same levels of activity in major urban centres. Will they be hollowed out, just as you say? And there's quite a lot of evidence that the longer this goes on, that's exactly what's happening. So maybe I'm in my shorts for a little bit longer to come.
You mentioned quotes from various MPs. I absolutely love the one from Charles Walker. Do you see that quote there? He says, let me just find it. He says that this could be a return for youngsters to the dark satanic mills.
Well, that's very tabloid language. He is talking to a tabloid newspaper, of course. But I think there is a germ of truth in what he says, in that I know that people are working harder than ever. There's no travel, there's no commute, so you're able to pack in more and more and more activity. And of course, young people in particular, it's much, much harder to learn a new craft, to learn a new skill, if you're not around your more senior colleagues who can kind of show you what to do. So, you know, it's very, very, very extreme language, but underneath that language, he has a point.
I'm not quite sure that's what Blake meant, though. Will those feet in future times walk back into the office? Ian Anderson, thank you very much for joining us. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Finally on today's show, it's time to turn our attention to what's making the news this week in the world of film. And to find out more, I am joined in person by the film critic Karen Krasanovich. Good morning to you.
Nice to be here.
It's really good lovely morning. To have you here. Let's start talking about everybody's favourite, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah, isn't it great? I saw In the Heights earlier this week, and it is West Side Story, you know, with lots more in it. But there's been a controversy recently. Director gave an interview to a video magazine called In the Roots, where they were discussing the fact that despite the fact that In the Heights is predominantly about a Latinx neighborhood, that there weren't enough darker-skinned people in the leading roles. And Lin-Manuel Miranda tweeted that yes, he could have done better, and he wished he had, and he's very aware of the feedback. And then on Colbert's show, Rita Moreno came on, who was promoting her own documentary about her own life, saying that we should kind of lay off him for a little bit and let the film be released. It's already been held up a year, and it's just come out, and people are talking, the fact that it's only made $11 million to a $55 million budget, they're saying, oh, it's not going to do well. Well, I think it's going to have longer legs than that. But I think he's handling this controversy incredibly well.
Yeah. Let's move to Australia now, where there's a new studio.
Yes. Russell Crowe, who's been talking about it for 25 years, living here on Coffs Bay, has now said that we're going to have a new studio with four sound stages and one tank, which is really important, despite the fact they've got beautiful coastline. It's going to be called Pacific Bay Studios, and it's conveniently built next to a hotel and resort complex. Would you think, why? Well, crews are big. They work in shifts. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, exciting stuff. But as you say, he's been talking about it forever. Will it happen?
Well, COVID has really brought a lot of us to our senses when it comes to how much we need movie making. And Prime Video, Hulu, and Netflix have all taken productions down there because it is very safe. And there isn't a studio there. So if there's a studio, people will go. So I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, we all do need movies, but some of us need movies more than others, including this person who chained themselves to a cinema.
I've been doing a lot of research on this art. There's this whole story about the Utah Plantagenet, I hope I'm saying that correctly, cinema, which was built in 1918. It was a thriving movie theater from the 30s to the 70s. And now the mayor has said, we're going to knock it down for a 31-story glass cantilever building. With 10% affordable housing, don't forget that. And there is a whole movement to save this incredibly important cinema, which is much more interesting on the inside. The outside, it looks quite modest. But Michael Valentine, they're calling him a film buff and an activist. He's actually a filmmaker. So really, you have to be very careful with this article, because I think that this theater does need to be saved. And I think that Erin Mendenhall, the mayor, needs to say this theater is not just for the elite, not like that glass tower block she wants to build.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, finally, this is a story that I absolutely love.
I did this one for you. I thought, let's have some fun. Okay, Stephen O. Young, who's a franchise stuntman with Star Wars, what a great gig as long as you don't get hurt, trained with Adam Driver, and he says while he was training Driver to use a lightsaber, Adam Driver made lightsaber noises with his mouth.
Pew, 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 like that.
Pew, 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 exactly. Which Laura Dern did as well, which we think is adorable. But he said to Adam Driver, please don't do it while you're filming.
And did he?
I don't believe he did, but everybody's going to be watching now to see if he did.
I really want to know, though, why people feel absolutely compelled to make that noise, because they do. I read the story, immediately started doing it, spoke to our sound engineer, Louis, there. He started doing it, too. It's contagious.
You can't help it. I mean, when I was a kid and playing cowboys, I used to take sticks and go pew, pew with my mouth, you know. And there is this thing. It just, the sound is part of the lifesaver. It's just, you can't just swing it, otherwise it's just a stick, right?
It is just a stick, though,
just
right?
Just a fluorescent bulb, right?
Yeah.
You have to have the pew, pew, otherwise it's not Star Wars.
Karen Krasanovich, pew, 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 pew is pew. The way we're going to end this. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. And that's all for today's programme. Some would say that is a mercy. Thanks to our producers, Rhys James, Paige Reynolds, Alexis Self and Charlie Filmer-Court, our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager, Louis Allen, with editing assistance from Chris Ablakwa. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and the briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. Emma Nelson will be in the chair, and I will be back with you on Saturday for Monocle on Saturday, and on Sunday for Meet the Writers, where my guest will be Jane Thin, who is got a brand new book out. It's called Widowlands. It's absolutely fabulous. So all of that coming out, lots of great listening here on Monocle 24. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for tuning in. Pew, pew.